The Diary of Ellen Rimbauer, Disc 7.
February 17th, 1917, Rose Red. For the last 18 months, suspicious again about your role, dear diary, in the strange and entangled events of this grand house, I have kept thought and soul to myself, never sharing them with your pages, no matter how great the temptation. No ghosts to look over my shoulder, goes my reasoning, if nothing is being put to paper. Alas, my plan has had little consequence. I sit down here to write in an act of desperation. This is not one of Poe's gory inventions of fiction, no young girl who can set schools afire, no dog that behaves as if possessed, no giant pendulum swinging to cut one in half. If there exists some wraith, some bodily spirit here in this room with me, if he or she can hear my thoughts as the wet ink travels from my pen to parchment, if, in fact, said entity has any modicum of compassion still held in reserve, then you, it, must certainly heed a mother's cry. My sweet child has gone missing. Help me. I offer anything in return if sign be shown to indicate such an exchange. Money? My own soul? My life? My husband's? What's that? I ask. A voice in reply? A wind? It is at this point I notice my east window has slipped open, and I fear the woman's voice I did detect was nothing more than nature's idle callings from the forest that surrounds these walls. Nonetheless, dear diary, I do speak again into the privacy of my room, after securing this window shut and locked. Did you speak to me? Is anyone there? Again, and I swear this on my life, a rumbling grew from beneath my trembling legs and swept through my ears like a whisper. Hello? I call out. Another window open, this time in my reading room, a lovely place for meditation and study, just off my bedroom chamber, opposite the first of my two dressing rooms. I hurry through, about to shut it against the swirling wind and rain that engulf this awful tomb, when I think that perhaps this is how you speak to me, Rose. A mother's hysterical anguish? I ask myself. Or is there reason behind this assumption? As your voice grows stronger, I can picture my sweet April in the bed behind me so vividly, her golden curls thrown back against a pillow, her high little voice whispering to me, "Whales don't have noses." Or is it you? Are you there? I call out into my chambers. Are you with me, Rose? Nothing comes back at me. No sign that I can take to heart. No indication that my girl has only been borrowed, not stolen instead. I tremble, my head unstable. I swear I hear the words return. The dower. Though these words make no sense to me, I am grateful for any sibilance, any sustenance to what previously was discerned as only wind. The dowry? I wonder, reminded of my marriage. The dowager? Help me, I pray. I return again to the empty reading room, my head spinning as I turn on my heels, a blur of the book's leather bindings floor to ceiling, the stained glass lamp I bought in Venice, the carpet from Constantinople. All these and more I would trade in a beat of the heart for even a sign that my child has been spared. Never mind what I would surrender for the child herself. This mother's life in an instant. Just give me a sign. I stand now, the window thrown open to the storm, debating throwing myself to the slate of the garden path below in sacrifice. All I await is the sign. Give me such a sign, and I am yours. A flash of lightning? A cry from the forest beyond? I see instead the unsteady flickering of the policemen's flashlights as they patrol our woods, and wish it were a sign. I hear the thundering voice of my husband, a world away, in the entry hall below. Find her! Find my child! He is in a fit of rage, ordering staff and police alike. There are 50 police here searching for my April. I fear that, like me, John, too, is making his prayers heard to your spirits, Rose, making offerings for an exchange. How this parent's heart breaks at the thought of any harm coming to my April. The main focus of the search began in the kitchen, where April was last seen playing tea. The enormous architect's model of the grand house just out of reach. Sukina reports that the child was playing by herself and seemed quite content at the time. I fear that John has directed his fears to Sukina herself, for I'm told by Millicent that Sukina has been sequestered in the staff kitchen, where she is being questioned by the police. Try as I might to intervene, to free her from this unfair suspicion, John sent me to my chambers, and this is one time I dare not challenge my husband, for his mood is aggressive and even frightening. April was left for a moment as Sukina neatened the pantry. She believes the pantry another of the house's portals. When Sukina turned around, April was gone. Oh, how my world is turned upside down all of a sudden. Indeed, it has been askew for some time, but only now do I admit to the full effects of such behavior. I would never doubt Sukina's explanation of events whatsoever. I trust my friend beyond any other. She explained also that at no time did April leave the kitchen, nor did she call out. Nor was there any cause for alarm, nothing whatsoever out of the ordinary. When next she looked, the kitchen stood empty. Only the tea set and that model, a grotesque representation of our grand house, planted firmly in the center of the kitchen table, the house's wings and extensions growing from its original form like some tumorous root. Not a lock of hair, not a fiber of clothing, just the empty room and, of course, Sukina. A moment later, a scream. John claims it was Sukina. Sukina says it was the house itself. I stand at my window, eyeing it as my escape from this pain. I never imagined a heart could endure such torture. I never understood the depth of this great love, how encompassing, how whole and complete. Dare I say it here? Yes, there were times I wished the children would go away. Yes, there were times I longed for that simplicity of husband and wife in the cabin of the Ocean Star, with nothing but time between great lavish meals, the best wines, and the intrigues of physical discoveries. But now, just the thought of such selfishness is enough to make me sick. How gladly I would recapture the slightest whisper of such wishes. How simple that window looks to me. How effortless to end it here. I drag the Louis XVI settee to rest before the window and think to remove my shoes before stepping onto her pink and green silk upholstery, my dress held high around my thighs. And I awkwardly squeeze myself into the open frame, looking down between my feet at the looming darkness. I teeter there, half in, half out, whispering prayers repeatedly, the drumming of my blood in my ears, as images of sweet April swirl and fill the void in my chest where once my heart resided. Oh, wind, talk to me now. Summon me now. Say but a single word. Jump, and you shall own me forever, or what is left of it. I can see beyond the slate rooftop of the pool house to the rising wing I commissioned at the instruction of Madame Stravinsky. I would haul it all down in a second for the affirmation of life in my precious child. I shudder at the thought of immortality that fails to include my children, fails to include those I love. Sukina, my mother and father. Who would wish for the curse of the endless extension of a life without family, a life without love? If Rose has taken my dear child, is it because I built too slowly, or because I built at all? Is it because I have shared my bed with the sweet child for nearly 2 years, or because I allowed my husband to send the boy away to school? How much is a product of those things I control, and how much those I do not? Do I confess my sins now from the pious mount of this open window, the fireflies of flashlights blinking in the woods? He is unfaithful, I shout from my pulpit. I am unfaithful. I hesitate. I hear a voice. Rose red, I wonder. I shout, I live, torn by lust, corrupted by a woman's gentle, loving touch. I want Sukina to hear this. I want her to understand. The guilt has been too much to bear. Rose red has punished us for what we've done in secret these many months. She has taken my child to show me the ways of such wickedness. Such sweet wickedness it was, love as I have never known. I want my husband to hear, to pierce his heart the way he pierced mine so many years ago. Alas, it is not to be. My rumblings from my perch echo from the acres of rooftops, and I spot Sukina through the glass roof of the solarium. She has broken free of her interrogators and is appealing, in cloistered silence, to me, with the pained expression of the only one who cares. Don't do it, her expression calls out. Don't jump. I look on as a uniformed policeman approaches her in the solarium, the policeman not seeing me, but me seeing him. I look on as Sukina spots his arrival. She lifts her arms like a musical conductor and throws her head back in a haunting display of the quiet powers she possesses. He retches, gripped by a pain in the stomach, and I am reminded of our encounter in the Cairo market all those years before. I watch, as impossibly, the thorny vines of Sukina's remarkable indoor garden, lush as it is with African creepers and exotic botanical varieties from our year abroad, come alive with alarming speed. I watch as that dense greenery runs up the glass as if 1,000 snakes, sprouts racing from the soil demonically. I watch as that policeman, already halted in his approach, is suddenly tangled and overcome by the twisting, creeping choke of that instant jungle. As he is consumed, Sukina, shaking her hands invitingly. The density of the tangle overcoming even my view of the events below as the glass is obscured. And then I see the policeman no more. My maid's delicate hands fall back to her sides. In stunned amazement, I watch as the overgrowth recedes as quickly as it came, suddenly alive with color and bloom, a paralyzing red of bougainvillea, orchid, and, dare I admit it, roses. More red roses than I have ever laid eyes upon. With that canopy removed from overhead, my friend dares to look once again in my direction. We are quite some distance, and yet her face is close enough to feel her warm breath, to drink her earthy perfume. She shakes her head in denial. She will not allow me to jump, will not allow me to end it, will not leave April unfound, and Adam without a mother, only that monster of a father, my husband, to help him fashion a life, to control her destiny. I am condemned by my love, of this blue-skinned woman, of my magical son, of a driven man I once allowed to impregnate me with his seed and thus spoil my fertility forever. What a fool I feel, exposed like this in an open window, as several of the officers break from the forest with their lights, called by my shouting and ranting and raving. And then I see him, John, below me and to my left, at one of the many doors leading to the garden. Sukina sees him too, though he does not take note of her. The three of us, me on the ledge, John, blithering and drunk, and terrified he has lost his daughter to this tomb we call home. Sukina, surrounded by her murderous blush and bloom of a thousand red blossoms. I laugh wildly, hysterically, maniacally. I laugh for the policeman to hear. I laugh for my husband to be sick. I laugh at the moon and the clouds, the wind in my ears speaking as rose red. She lives, says the wind. She lives in the dower. Only then do my ears forgive me. Only then do clarity and alacrity impose themselves. A comprehension by the ear prepares me for the understanding that is to follow. It is not dower, as I once supposed. The word I am to hear is tower. And Rose Red is whispering clearly that this is where my daughter's future lies, where my daughter now resides. The tower. A tower not yet built. 3 a.m. Rose Red. Sukina's chambers. I shudder to relate to you, dear diary, the tragic events of the past several hours. Not long after the dramatic occurrence in the solarium and my brief encounter with my husband, did a sense of dread invade me that rivaled the disappearance of my dear child only hours earlier. I knew in an instant that this dread involved Sukina, and that my own intervention was required to spare my sweet friend. I have suffered much infirmity these several years, nearly always cautious in my walking about, not to lose balance and fall to the floor like some invalid. Yet on this night, the eyes I must have raised with the staff as I ran down the west wing's second-story halls and flew down the grand stair, my feet barely lighting as I descended. Drastic action was required of me. I knew this without so much as a single thought. My response was born from within me, having little or nothing to do with any kind of thought process, and for this reason I trusted it, I suppose, or at least I followed it without question. "No, John!" I heard myself calling out in an unfamiliar tone, a tone a wife should never use to address her husband, especially in public. I tell you, dear diary, it was not my voice at all, but one given to me, just as the quickness of limb was given to me, just as the voice in the séance was given to me. This, in turn, begs a greater question upon which I hope to expound at a later date. That is, if not my voice, if the voice of Rose Red, as I firmly believe, then why was she speaking through me in an attempt, vain as it turned out, to save Sukina? Has this house come to listen to my handmaid? To talk to her? Do they share some connection about which I am previously unaware?
You let her go!
I roared at him in a voice that was not mine. John knew that other voice. He is smarter than other men, wiser, more experienced. He recognized that voice immediately as being the voice of the Grand House. Paralyzed, he stood, flat-footed, as I ran toward him, my dress rising behind me like a shadow. Two policemen had Tsukina by the arms and were dragging her toward the open door, beyond which I could see a car waiting. The police in this city are a model of corruption and influence peddling. Mayor Gill, now in his third term, has attempted to change our image by closing the body houses and saloons that people the water frontage. He would not dare touch the police, for they control this town, including the actions of the mayor. If Tsukina was placed in that car, I knew well that I might never see her again. As I approached my husband at full speed, a thought sparked through me. What if April had not disappeared at all? What if my husband had ordered her removed briefly by one of the loyal staff? What if this evening's anxiety was nothing more than the result of a deftly scripted act of deceit intended to lay blame on my maid and win her forcible removal from our home? What if his plans called for her beating, her jailing, and the pox or other illness that seemed to claim the lives of so many of this city's jailed? April is removed for one night, and John reclaims the power over his wife and destroys the one person in this house who has more power than him. Discounting the house itself, of course. Had my husband tricked me? Tricked us all, including the police, whom he may have bought off, in an effort to regain his single authority? John caught me unawares. He extended his arms in advance of my fast approach and knocked me off my feet, throwing me down onto my behind, where I skidded across the polished wood and came to rest against the wall, directly beneath my own portrait.
"She heard her scream," he roared. "The only person to claim to hear anything."
"She heard the house scream," I cried, for I was quite aware of Tsukina's first-hand report. He snorted derisively at me.
"It was our daughter, Ellen, our daughter's last sounds, and this woman must answer for it."
Answer for it? This woman? Does she answer for the disappearances? For your partner's suicide? I caught him with my defiance. "It is this house, and you know it."
"I know nothing of the sort."
An officer remained in the open doorway. Beyond him, I saw Tsukina violently thrown into a police wagon, her head striking the frame. She glanced back in my direction. It was the last I saw of her. I have not seen her since. John nodded toward the officer, my husband clearly giving his okay. And again my thoughts of conspiracy surfaced. John had a greater hand in this than I thought. The man pulled the door shut.
"No!"
I cried out. "A cop has disappeared, Ellen," my husband said. "The woods," I said, making no mention of the sudden bloom in the solarium. "There are dozens of them in the woods. One is lost, is all."
"They found a belt, a policeman's belt, on the floor of the solarium. Tsukina was in the solarium at the time.
I think it's time you faced up to the fact that your...
what is she exactly? Your friend grew jealous of your time with our daughter and has brought her harm. Indeed, has removed her from the face of this earth."
"You bastard!" bastard, John Rimbauer. He bent down and slapped me across the cheek. Tears leaped from my eyes, like beads of juice from an orange slice.
I'm sorry,
he mumbled. In our 10 years together, my husband had never laid a hand on me in this way. Perhaps it was the jarring that this blow caused me, my husband unleashing his anger. Perhaps it was simply the right time for me to see the truth, as unadorned as it so often is. For me, that slap of his was like sunlight through a magnifying glass, directed, fierce, intense. A light so bright as to be blinding. Surprisingly, my husband had it half right. He had nailed it on the head. Jealousy. The clarity of that thought. I thought I heard the voices of choirs in my ears. Jealousy. But half right was all. He was wrong about the source of that jealousy. Felt over the past 2 years, as I focused my every waking moment on the love and progression of sweet April. Not Tsukina at all, but Rose Red. She'd grown jealous. And she'd fed off the substantial life force of my child as a way of extending her own longevity and striking out at me all at once. Two birds with one stone. Rose Red has claimed April. She has removed Tsukina as well. She has me all to herself now. And I shudder at what that means. February 20th, 1917. Rose Red. Horror of horrors. Do I dare relate what I know now about the events of the past 3 days? I know not how much of what has happened was the result of my husband's instruction, his determination, and how much simply the result of a corrupt and bigoted police force. Naturally, I would prefer to believe the latter, as I must continue through this lie of a marriage to the former, and thereby, perhaps, the blame for it all should be laid at my feet, and mine alone. When I think back now to what I might have done to save my dear Tsukina, had it not been for fear, had it not been for grief over the loss of my sweet April, perhaps I would have been in the presence of mind to formulate some plan, to articulate my degree of concern, to make demands upon my husband and those clearly under his control. Tsukina has failed to return from the police station, or wherever it is they have taken her. 3 full days have passed since April's disappearance, and I am teetering on the brink of suicide, haunted by my husband's continued stalking of this house like a cat after a mouse, and his approval when the police hauled off my handmaid late that night in a pitiful rainstorm. Finally, about an hour ago, I received word, through surreptitious means that I dare not go into, not even in your trusted pages, dear diary, except to say that one of the staff is close friends with a young woman whose brother serves on the police department, and that through this connection I have been privy to information that otherwise should have never reached my ear. The word is this. Tsukina has been under lock and key in a basement room in City Hall for the past 3 days and nights. She has been denied food, sleep, and even the common decency of a toilet. I am of information that she has been beaten, berated, and quite possibly violated in the way only a woman can be violated, while her captors continue to demand and await her confession. A piece of fiction she has quite properly, steadfastly, refused to provide them. I am of a state so wrought with grief and overcome with anxiety that I am in one of my fevers, confined to bed, and only weakly able to make this account in your pages tonight. Immediately upon hearing of Sukina's treatment, her predicament, I wrote my husband a brief note upon my personal stationery and had it delivered by Yvonne, a woman I trust implicitly. My note read something like this. Dear husband, it has come to my attention that persons unknown, namely the police, or persons masquerading as the same, are torturing and mistreating my dear friend and African handmaid in their pursuit of the truth as concerns our dear departed daughter. I am quite aware that you continue to attribute the random spirits of this house to Sukina, and to place her in the blame for events here. This, despite my many objections to such an attitude. You now apparently harbor suspicions that include the disappearance of our dear April. I beg you to review the events as they stand. What I hope to remind you of is that Mr. Corbin's actions predated my even meeting Sukina by over a year. Furthermore, during the séance with Madame Stravinsky, it was Sukina, and only Sukina, who attempted to stop the events of that evening, to disconnect us all from Rose Red, not to encourage us to listen. On the night of April's disappearance, only Sukina heard this wretched house scream. Your suspicions are incorrect and ill-founded, and I beseech you to use whatever relationships with which you are bestowed to return home at once my most senior staff member, be they these relationships with the police, the politicians, or with her abductors themselves. If any more harm, any lasting harm, comes to Sukina, I shall hold you personally responsible, John. Any resulting investigation will, by necessity, include you and your role in her initial removal from this household. Your wife. I signed it Ellen Rimbauer, as I have found deliberate use of my formal name to be suggestive of a strong attitude on my part, and quite a successful technique where negotiations with John are concerned. I licked the envelope, sealed it, and wrote his name on the front. Mr. John Rimbauer. All informality gone. Since that time, I have turned to your pages as a means of escape, for I cannot bear the thought of my dear Sukina in the condition in which she presently finds herself. About the only good any of this has done is to distract me from a mother's sorrow, however briefly. Sitting here just now, I have heard John's motor car depart the property. My heart swells with hope that Sukina is to be returned. But there is a second sound as well, which I shall now investigate. It comes from inside the walls, and sounds ever so much like the sawing of wood. Perhaps not inside the walls, exactly, but overhead instead. Guest chambers occupy the space directly above my own rooms, and above these, the attic. I shall return to your pages, but first I must find the source of these peculiar sounds. If for no other reason than to put my mind at rest that little April isn't still to be found here, having been mistakenly overlooked while having gotten herself injured. Hope clings to every branch. I quiver in the wind. I shall dress in pants and a sweater, and I shall explore Rose Red like never before. Damn them all. 4 a.m. I have always taken your pages in confidence, but never so much as now, as the darkness of this place makes itself so plainly evident. My curiosity drove me to the floor above my own west wing chambers in search of the mechanical noises that sounded to me like wood being sawed. To no great surprise, I found the chambers above my own unoccupied. However, in a keen search of the hallway there, I found a panel that, when pressed upon with both hands, sprang open far enough to admit a person. I slipped inside, studied the panel to make sure I knew I could reopen it, and, deciding I could, pulled it shut. I entered a dark, narrow passage, no wider than my slim frame, and moved around a corner to where I found myself standing at a cloudy window. Yes, a piece of glass, large and substantial, that looked in on the principal dressing room off the guest quarters' master bedroom. Only then did I realize this piece of glass was the dressing room's mirror, and that I was on the other side of it. I continued on down the narrow corridor, past the next turn, finding a panel that moved out of the way. Climbing up a step clearly intended for same, it allowed me to insert my head into a wooden box and find my eyes looking out the mouth of one of John's African game trophies, right at the guest bed itself. Farther down the corridor, another backside of a mirror. This time, inappropriately looking in on the sink, toilet, and bath. My husband's fantasies might very well include watching women dress and undress, might include watching the couples invited to stay the night as they are engaged in the most intimate courting rituals. But the idea of my husband, or any man, leering at a woman in the privacy of her toilet made me sick to my stomach. I had heard of such observation stations built into the staff quarters. Having never found one, I had not protested. But locating such a nefarious viewing platform as the mouth of a dead beast, and another allowing study of a woman's toilet habits, and both directed at our dear guests, filled me with anger. Worse, this hall of delight did not stop there. I followed it more deeply into Rose's walls, turning left twice, a fraction of light seeping in through holes I gather were drilled for this purpose. A right-hand turn, and then, at my feet, a perfect square of white lines. Light. I knelt, tried to move the square panel there in the floor, and finally made it slide open exactly an inch. I put my head to it, lying on the floor as I imagined was intended. I was looking down onto my own bed, the electric lamp by my pillow strong enough to turn the sheer suspended over my four-poster into a transparency. I could see clearly enough to read the Holy Bible in gold on the nightstand. I panicked as only a guilty person can, first in anger, then in guilt. Not everything in that bed had been innocent. Not every moment of tender loving in that bed had included my husband. Now I thought I understood his jealousy and anger toward Tsukina. Now I knew, his fantasies aside, he had witnessed me, us, there, and that no matter how it may have excited him, it had repulsed him as well, and he had taken action. For the faintest moment, I even allowed myself to believe my husband had done something to little April, or, and I'd thought this earlier, had hired one of the staff to take her away briefly, to allow suspicion to fall upon my maid, to satisfy the convenience of the police being in attendance. Perhaps more than one of the staff. Perhaps his loyal corps of servants. The children's young governesses had been acting strangely of late. Conspiracy worked hard to replace my own sense of debauchery and unfaithfulness, and I managed to turn my own misgiving into a strong resentment of my husband in no time. I continued on. Shortly thereafter, the corridor did rise and climb via a set of steep stairs to a padded trapdoor that led directly into the attic. Here were kept many of the dozens and dozens of items collected while on our honeymoon, and still not put to good use. Here were sewing stands, pottery, and a second set of stairs that, when descended, led directly into the back of the lesser closets in my husband's primary changing room. This second set of stairs afforded him escape to his rooms if overheard or pursued, or a way to reach from his rooms into the attic, back down to the guest quarters, and out into the hallway. I was guessing already that I had missed a secret door leading right into the guest bedroom, a way for John to enjoy the pleasures of our single women guests while escaping attention. A certain opera star came to mind. For a while, a year or so ago, she had lived with us while performing downtown. I sensed she had been performing in my house as well. When I look at it this way, there is much for Rose Red to be angry about, dear diary. We have abused her repeatedly. I did not return immediately, for what took my breath away, what startled me to the point of swooning and nearly fainting, had nothing whatsoever to do with John's philandering or even his secret passages. I'd come to grips with my husband's perverted shortcomings years ago. No, dear diary, not my husband. It was the fresh board, the steel carpenter's saw, the horses, and the fresh pile of sawdust that caught my eye. A door that I did not remember. I inspected this work. The saw's blade felt warm to the touch. The sawdust smelled of fresh cedar. There, a framed door stood in the middle of the attic, alone, and all by itself. A door to nowhere, connected both top and bottom. For unexplainable reasons, I picked up the saw, inserted its warm teeth into the sawed slot, and put my hand to it. A moment later, the end piece of wood broke free and fell with a clatter, for I had neglected to hold it or to catch it. Someone had been up here working while I lay in my bed, trying to pray for Sukina's release to freedom. Someone had been building Rose Red. But who, dear diary? Who on our staff works this time of night? What carpenter saws in the dark? And why did I see that board and that handsaw much more as an invitation? Far less mystery than mastery. I am to help build this house. The tower where my captured daughter is said to live and from where she will seek her freedom. A tower that has yet to be built. I am to help build it. I know this with absolute certainty. To build it in secrecy. Perhaps Adam will help when he's home from school. He too will want to reach April as soon as possible. Am I losing my mind as quickly as I'm losing those I love? I must schedule my day to make room for this endeavor. I must prepare to wear blisters on my hands, to smuggle lumber stolen from our other construction and into the attic late at night when no one else suspects. April, I fear, lives on the other side of that unbuilt door. April awaits her mother. John has just now returned from his journey into town, and I could wait no longer. I ran, yes, ran, down the grand stair to that very same spot where he had shoved me days earlier, and I pleaded with him for some news of my friend. "Your friend?" he asked. Yes, John. She is my friend. I practically dragged him into the parlor. The suit of armor, our only eavesdropper. I secured the door shut and beseeched him. Dear husband, I beg you for news of my friend. You call me husband, and yet do not allow me into your chambers, woman. What kind of husband is that? It had never crossed my mind that the man wanted into my chambers. Our child was missing. How could any other words escape his mouth? All these months of not so much as a kiss between us, I had assumed his transgressions with the women of the night had satisfied whatever urges a man like John Rimbauer has. Substantial urges indeed. But now I saw before me another man altogether. Pitiful. And I wondered, a deeper, darker thought, if some curse had not befallen my husband, some curse that is said to afflict some men, and that if, in his twisted, self-centered way, he had attributed that curse to Sukina, and that this explained her abduction by the police, and therefore, quite possibly, my missing daughter. Had John not dared to harm Sukina himself because of her substantial powers? Had he concocted the disappearance of our daughter as a means to rid himself of my maid with the help of the police? Or had he spent time in secret observation of my bedroom and the acts that had taken place there between me and my friend? Was jealousy his master now? Had I somehow risen to a level of power over him that to this moment I had been unaware of? I was unaware you had interest in my bedroom, John. I have not heard your knock upon my door for many months. Or, I was thinking, had the act of man with woman become meaningless without the sense of love? Had the only curse upon my husband been a curse he had brought upon himself? Perhaps he was now incapable of the other kind of love, and in need of the love he and I had once shared, however briefly. Perhaps April's disappearance had something to do with this, making John aware of external powers that he could not, in fact, control, powers he associated with Sukina, and hence his lashing out at her. Perhaps this man was boy again, and in me sought a mother to whom he could turn. It was everything I could do, dear diary, to remain composed under the weight of Sukina's prolonged absence and the disappearance of my lovely daughter. For these were the only two subjects of my inquiry, and I found John's diversions annoying and entirely self-centered, which should not have surprised me one bit. "I believe you've had other interests," he said. "You've been preoccupied with April and Sukina." And they were both gone. This fact did not escape me. I shuddered, head to toe. Had my husband conceived of this grand plan to remove my two loves and refocus my ardor upon himself? Had I misread him all these years? Was he, in fact, more deeply in love with me than I'd ever understood? I prayed for composure, understanding fundamentally that these next few minutes were to determine the fate of my maid. In truth, I feared the fate of my child had already been decided, and that my husband had had nothing to do with it, no matter how my mind schemed. My discovery in the attic, the voice in the wind telling me of the tower, it all made so much sense to me now. John was jealous, and so was Rose Red. I swallowed my pride and said, "My bedroom door is always open to you, dear husband. You will find me a most needing
and willing partner in this regard. Will I? Oh, yes. I hated him for this. Me, picturing Sukina being beaten, or worse, while my husband negotiated his visitation rights and my obligations to his depravity. Always the businessman. John Rimbauer got what he wanted, and he played any card necessary to that end. I know you've been with her, he said. I lowered my head in shame. I could not look at him. Why, I wondered, did this man in particular, possess the power to make me feel guilty? How could such an exaggeration be allowed? I nodded, acknowledging his accusations. My lips quivered. My breath drew short. Your needs are physical, I whispered dryly. I need love, John. And you found it? I said nothing. I felt afraid, so terribly afraid. Not of him, this weak excuse of a man, but afraid of losing both April and Sukina. Afraid of being driven to a place where my only friend might turn out to be this witch of a house, Rose Red herself. I could see myself driven to torment over her construction, my hands raw, my eyes filled with sawdust, my clothes dirty and dusty, as I worked furiously to build her bigger and stronger. I feared the future. I wished then, wished with all my heart, that I had been brave enough to jump those several nights earlier. Only death would offer silence, sanctuary. I knew this absolutely. I said, I found companionship, solace. I'm at peace, John, I lied. I will taste this peace as well, he said, stepping up to me. He'd been drinking, heavily, I thought. Another consideration entered me, flooded me with possibility. He was tormented himself. He'd not been sleeping. I knew this. Had been drinking too much of late. Perhaps his past sins had finally caught up to this man in the late stages of middle age. Perhaps he saw that the end was near, at least nearer than the beginning, and that he had isolated himself in a place where peace was only a word, not a form of existence, a concept, not a reality. Mistakenly, as always, he thought this peace could now be negotiated, bought, instead of earned. You and this woman, he said. He could rarely bring himself to say her name. I will join you in your chambers. The rumblings of a drunken man, I wondered? Or had he witnessed the affection, the kindness, the pure love that transpired between my maid and me, and believed he could include himself in this exchange? Shaking from fear, I stepped even closer, my voice now more like that wind I'd heard whispering in my ear. Whatever you want, John, it's yours for the asking. I felt nauseous. I wasn't going to make the mistake Douglas Posey had made. I said, I am here to serve you. He took his hands and placed them on my shoulders. His fingers extended like antennae. They gently rained down my body, lingering over my breasts, my waist, and hugging the curve of my hips. He let his hands once again hang at his side. He looked pale and quite frightened. Later, I would realize it was excitement at the thought of his proposal. His touch was eerily electric. I felt it like a poison running through my veins. I believe I can help her, he said.
He stormed from the room and back out the house. I heard his car sputtering toward the gates. I fell to my knees, and I retched. Regardless of the price I had just paid, my Sukina was coming home. February 22nd, 1917, Rose Red. John has worked tirelessly to free Sukina, and at last has brought her home. To see her, my dear friend, in such a state as this, brought me to tears, and for a time threatened to return me to fever and the echo of my African illness. But to my credit, I held these symptoms at bay, determined to be of help. Part of the long delay in my receiving her was John's delivering her to the hospital for the setting of bones and the mending of wounds. She is missing 3 front teeth and has a broken left wrist and a bandaged nose. In the privacy of her room, as Donna and I help her out of her bloodied and torn clothes and into a nightdress, we are painfully aware of the other atrocities that did befall her. Atrocities that a woman readily recognizes and that need no detailed explanation here in these pages. Suffice it to say, her black skin is deeply bruised from ribs to loin, from her breasts to the soles of her feet, and there is tearing and bleeding in places that make childbirth appear tame. I weep openly at the sight of what they've done to her, the uniformed men assigned to protect us. What cowards! They should all be made to hang for these crimes. Instead, they will return home to their wives, a bit weary, explaining away their fatigue as just another day on the beat. For her part, Sukina is sanguine as usual. She stops short of making jokes about her condition, but manages to impress us with a wincing smile, half pain, half delight, at her return to those who care for her. Donna is eventually replaced by Carol, a nurse that John has hired specifically to care for my maid in her weeks of recovery. Carol changes dressings on Sukina's wounds, applies ointments, and feeds her medicines. Sukina tolerates these efforts, but bids me to prepare her own herbal treatments, which include the burning of rope-like grasses, teas, and salves made from a variety of herbs she keeps in a rosewood chest in her changing room. I try to follow her instructions, requiring her to repeat them several times. I touch her all over, applying these African remedies, and reel when she winces in pain. There are clearly broken ribs, and, I fear, the bruising of internal organs, for her abdomen is quite enlarged on her right side, and she is refusing all food. Hours on end I pray for her, reading scripture aloud. She seems soothed by this, and we've talked about how Christian scriptures can heal given devotion and faith behind the words. Morning comes. Another day passes. March 13th, 1917, Rose Red. There is little doubt that April, whose month approaches with great sorrow, is not coming home. John did not hide her in some pretense or scheme. She is gone, lost to the walls of this place. Her residence here ensures that I shall never leave this place, never leave my child, not for more than a luncheon or dinner in town. I wonder if Rose intended this fate for me, thinking back to Sukina's claims that the house was jealous of my devotion to my daughter, and knowing that a mother would never leave her child when distant hope is held that my April may someday walk right out of the walls that have apparently claimed her. If indeed there was method to this house's madness, it has won that battle. I am here to stay. Tsukina's recovery impresses me greatly, and I attribute that recovery, in no small part, to both her herbs and my prayer. Some of the bruising remains. Bandages have been removed from her nose and other areas as well, and she is able to spend some time on her feet now and to tend to her toilet herself. Her wrist remains in plaster, her breathing shallow and quite evidently painful. She chants herself to sleep in that singing language of hers, almost like humming as it resonates inside her. I brush her hair and pat her head and rub her limbs when her legs go numb. She smiles and climbs to her feet and struggles around the room slightly bow-legged. I wince, unable to conceive of the awful things they did to her during her days in captivity. A policeman, a detective, returned to our home, ostensibly to follow up on April's disappearance, and upon sight of him, I ordered him from our home. I shouted, quite undignified, until the man, paralyzed with fear, fled from this place, hat in hand. No policeman shall ever set foot in this house again, not without proper paperwork and the order of a judge. I've had quite enough of the protection the police provide us. If they think they'll ever figure out Rose Red, they are fooling themselves. There is no earthly explanation for the events of this place. I have lived within these walls more than 8 years now, day in and day out. I have consulted Madame Lou and Madame Stravinsky, and I am wont to explain the goings-on. Young women disappearing, men dead of everything from suicide to murder, my daughter claimed, my husband now tortured with sexual inadequacy. I shudder with this last thought, recalling my negotiations to win Tsukina's release, and dreading the day I must report to my maid the price we both must pay for her freedom. Dreading even more the moment of payment itself. When will my husband come to my chambers? When will that demand be met? April 19th, 1917. Rose Red. A grim mood envelops us all as we mourn the loss of my dear daughter on this, her day. The staff feels this loss as painfully as John and I. The housemaids elected to forego their white aprons today, leaving them in all black as they mourn. For the most part, the house is quiet, and the only activities amount to the bare necessities to keep it operating. Construction, for the first day since Christmas, has been suspended. About the only occurrence of note was a shuddering growl heard by all sometime around 1 p.m. this afternoon. There was no mistaking the source. This house. This same time of day, 1 p.m., has lately been the hour of my retiring after lunch for rest. In fact, I have used these 2 hours to tend to my carpentry in the attic, making good headway on the stairs that are to lead to the tower. Only Tsukina has noticed the splinters and calluses on my hands, and in typical fashion has thought better than to ask me their source. I wonder now, has this sound we heard anything to do with my absence from the attic on this day? Is Rose Red so alive that she can even sense time and absence? If so, what is it she demands of me, and what am I to do to appease her? I take a late tea at 4 o'clock in the parlor, at first made weary by the unexpected arrival of Tina Coleman, but then made happier as I realized how badly I needed this distraction. Tina is very much aware of the significance of this day and comes to help me forget. She even brings a flask of alcohol and laces my tea with same. As our discussion wanes, I note that she can't take her eyes off the large leather globe in the corner of the room, recalling, perhaps, the stories of one of our first disappearances here. Do I see temptation in her eyes? Does she, too, want to spin this globe and see if Rose Red will claim her? She could try if she liked, but the truth is I had one of the staff place a screw into the globe to prevent it spinning many years ago. Each and every time Sukina identifies what she believes to be a portal into this house, I order it closed or shuttered. The stall in the carriage house, for instance, had been nailed shut following Daniel's brutal stomping. I must admit to a sense of melancholy and distress as the afternoon wore on. All the small talk in the world could not rid me of memories of my sweet little girl, and I fear the alcohol only served to increase my unease. Finally, too late, I'm afraid, Tina excused herself and took her leave, returning home by chauffeured motor car. I skipped dinner, filled with scones, and headed to my rooms to write here in your pages. 2 a.m. Do I dare write openly and honestly of the events of this evening? The evening anniversary of the birth of my missing child? If I do not, I fear that I shall carry this with me to my detriment, for I experience such relief when applying my pen to your pages. But, oh, dear diary, so private are these words, so frightening, that I scarcely dare repeat what has happened. Unable to sleep, unable barely to sit down, I have paced my chambers for the last hour, debating whether to share here in your pages the events of the past several hours. And now, alas, I take to your pages like the sinful to the confessional. It was shortly after 11 o'clock when I heard a knock on the outer door to my chambers. I had already let the staff go, and so was made to answer this inquiry myself. Believing it to be Sukina, who has found it difficult to sleep since her ordeal with the police, I approached in my nightgown, not bothering with a robe. To my great surprise, it was my husband. Further to my surprise was his apparent sobriety. I had not seen him since before tea, and had presumed him to be drinking quite heavily on this day. "Ellen," he said, his voice barely a whisper. "The pain is too great." I admitted him, and we embraced, hugged each other in a way we have not done in years. I cried. My husband remained stalwart, though was visibly shaken. As we hugged, his large hands held me from behind, rubbing me and pressing me to him, and I sensed immediately he had turned his grief into need. He wanted physical soothing. He kissed my neck, my throat, and I confess I shuddered with apprehension. I, too, needed this expression of love, needed some escape from my grief. He stopped my heart with his next words. "Send for her." I stammered, unable to draw a breath. There was no question to whom my husband referred. "John," I pleaded, but he pressed his finger to my lips and repeated himself, and I knew there was to be no arguing. I approached the door, preparing to summon one of my staff. I turned to him again, one final attempt to win favor. "John, dear husband, I offer myself in whatever regard you do wish. You may dress, undress me, position me any way you like. ask anything of me you so choose, but do not ask this. I have yet to inform her of our negotiations. I dare not tell her this way. Clearly, he considered my offer thoughtfully. He touched me as only a husband may touch a wife. Then he stopped abruptly and bid me to summon her.
Send for her, he repeated.
I knew better than to challenge him, especially in the face of his rescue, which may have saved Tsukina's life. Very well, I said. But leave my chambers for a time. Let me speak to her in private. Grant me this favor, my only request. Return in 30 minutes. You shall have what you wish.
This ends Disc 7.